what gave a moon its rotational force? I mean, what force? What that force originated from? Rotational form. We're talking about initial spin. What did it came from? Maybe Paul would be able to say something.
Okay, I'm not going to say much different than Roy because he's right on. I think you're going back to how the moon was formed. You know, it was a large body that crashed into the Earth. Then both things were flying off, and at that point they had some kind of momentum, and as they get the gravity pulled it together more and more, things start spinning. The Earth usually spins faster, and the Earth has slowed down. But you know, that material that flew off of the Earth after we were hit, probably with a Mars-sized planet, who knows, when those two things collided, you know, they go off. It all has some kind of spin to it, you know, and then when it starts to get, it just starts spinning fast, so, you know, like an ice skater pulling their arms in. So I would say the initial rotational force, if you want to go back that far, would be from the collision of the Earth and whatever hit it.
I'm going to repeat, Paul's going to repeat me, and we're going to be in an endless loop. Well, let me just read you one sentence from good old Google. Initial velocity. The moon's initial spin and orbital velocity were a direct result of the angular momentum conservation from the massive collision that formed the moon, which is what I said and what Paul said.
Okay, so there was a planet about the size of the Mars. The planet collided with Earth. Part of the planet was able to escape. The initial distance between Earth and that part was one-tenth of its actual distance. And every year there was some distance far away and far away and far away from the Earth, and the speed of that body was different, wasn't that of today, was much faster. So the question for that 8 year school reading whatever you're reading was if we take any two bodies of any mass and we collide them together, are we going to get rotational force? Back to you, Dr. Gold.
It depends at the initial state of the two objects and how they interact. If they merge together, if they break apart, but ultimately, like I keep on saying, and I'll say again, it's the angular momentum of the two objects that produce the present day Earth and the residual mode. It's conservation of energy laws, it's conservation of angular velocity laws. That's all. You know, I don't know what you want to make this of. You know, you kind of repeated what I said at the very beginning, which is, you know, the moon used to go fast and be closer to the Earth. Over time, it slowed down and it slowly moved away until it reached the present rotation speed, which made it possible for it to be tidally locked to the Earth, and it will stay tidally locked until it goes farther and farther away from the Earth and you know, lose that lock. I said that at the beginning, I said that at the middle, and now I'll say it hopefully at the end.
Yeah, I was trying to find for myself the best possible answer to the child's question. It wasn't that I'm trying to look smart or trying to say what I know. I'm not a professional in this area. I'm trying to make that question public because obviously the child is trying to know why we cannot observe on the Earth two bodies colliding and then cruising one next to each other. And why do we have a comet and other solar bodies? They are colliding with other bodies, but they just changing trajectory. They do not start to cruise around another body. And why all of the planets are in constant motion around other planets? Back to you.
TD2VHD.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, I'll throw a stink bomb into the room. If you do mind, I won't.
Well, if it isn't too stinky.
It's pretty stinky. So the moon is a very interesting thing, place, concepts, all that stuff. And whenever anybody gets involved in these interesting conversations, which they are very interesting, about the odd circumstances of the moon, if you don't address the fact that the moon just happened to come into existence over some weird cosmic collision, but it precipitated into a spherical form and it got an elliptical orbit and the whole thing that all happened just so happened to make it be the exact right size that as it passes between us and the sun to make a perfect shot that is exactly the right size to create these eclipses. I can't think of any math that describes how that's likely to occur other than just by random forces. The fact that the random forces that created the moon made it the exact right size to eclipse the sun. So, half of you say I'm crazy. But it's a strange circumstance, I think. Back to that, sorry to butt in late. Good conversation. Back to Roy.
It is. Okay, Jim. Yeah, what can I tell you? It is possible to just happen. I don't think it intrinsically proves a intelligent being created it, and you know, then you know, you could ask, well, why would it be terribly important if an intelligent creation, you know, intelligent force decided that he liked eclipses, so he built ours with an eclipse capable. So. You know, all well and good. I just wanted to point out that there seems to be a fallacy that Wes was talking about, that nothing collides with anything else. You know, the moon is scattered with craters. What do you think caused the craters? We get meteorites that strike the Earth. We had one that killed the dinosaurs. So, I mean, most of the times they pass by. Occasionally they collide. And sometimes they veer off and get trapped in an orbit. It doesn't have to be a planetary orbit. It could be an orbit within the solar system. So, I mean, objects, there's a lot of random objects through the universe. There's a lot of things that once upon a time were... See the point that you're trying to make, Wes, about, you know, why did something collide with
Why the batteries are spinning and why some of them just change gear director and some of them start to spin one neck around the other. Thank you very much. That was all what I had for today. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Hey, Wes, while we wait for them to come back, what about the moon Triton? It goes around Neptune. That actually rotates in the opposite direction than all the other moons. So we could talk about that forever, too. Let's see if Roy is back.
Yeah, I'm back. Unfortunately, All-Star hiccuped again.
Very good. Yes, man. You sound great, Roy.
Good. Yeah, I mean, you know, they don't all spin in the same direction. Most of them do. But, you know, vague, strange things happen. Different objects outside the solar system come inside the solar system and get captured. So, you know, the point is that, you know, you have to keep on remembering that angular momentum is conserved, and so all this rotational energy has no place to be dissipated. So that's why everything seems to spin. On the other hand, the forces that pull objects into the solar system's plane are not conserved. So things kind of bounce above the plane and below the plane early on in the history of the solar system until they kind of settle within a specific plane, and they don't really travel that far away from it after that.
There is something that I sent to Paul and you. And it was kind of puzzling me. And the video is called "The Moment We've Been Anticipating for Decades Has Begun." And this is by geophysicist Stephen Byrne. Report on the incredible once-in-a-lifetime energy conversions that has begun with eclipse season, the Saturn-Neptune great conjunction, and enhanced space weather, increasing earthquake activity, and weather systems. The question for both of you is, why solar weather is able to trigger or alter earthquakes? I understand that it can change the weather, but earthquakes, how that mechanism works? Maybe Paul could say a few words.
I missed the question on that one.
KC2GS. Yeah, Wes, basically it's gravitational forces. If there's an alignment of planetary objects such that their mass lines up, it produces a slight gravitational effect, and it can affect, I guess, plate tectonics and such. But it's not a sure thing. It's just, I think they correlated alignment with a slight increase in the frequency of earthquakes. But that's, you know, you can't kind of depend on it, and you can't say what part of the earth is going to have slightly increased tremors. But, you know, I mean, it's a gravitational.
Paul?
No. I'm not really sure of the whole question. So I didn't copy that. So, back to you, Ross.
Yeah, Paul, he's asking if space weather can, how space weather or space environment causes geological and earth problems, changes and such. And I think he's alluding to the idea that during some gravitational alignment of planets, there's a slightly increased incidence in tremors from, earthquakes and such.
Yeah, in other words,
the video, halfway through it, I know it was only, 20 minutes long, but I got interrupted and never completed that. But yeah, the idea of different planets aligning and putting some kind of extra stress on the internal part of our planet, that doesn't sound right. The inverse square law is really a big deal, especially when it comes to gravity. You know, something, you know, like the sun and another planet being in line with one another. The sun is gigantic. Let's say it's Venus, you know. Venus is relatively small compared to the sun. It's not going to make any kind of a change. So that means that the constant gravitational pull on the Earth from the Sun is constant. You know, the planet goes in front of it, and the density, you know, of the two compared the Sun to Venus or any other planet is minimal. You know, so it's not going to have that much of a very, very little effect, I'm sure. You know, I don't think it's going to change the internal structure of the Earth at all. So, And as far as, you know, I mean, you could definitely change the atmosphere. You know, you have solar activity, and that's going to, you know, raise the elevation of the atmosphere to, you know, slow down satellites and things. Eventually, I guess some of the molecules will escape Earth, so maybe Earth will get slightly lighter, you know, over eons of time. But, you know, for everything that you lose in that respect, you know, you always have meteors and comets hitting the Earth all the time. So you're going to add material to the Earth. So my guess is it'll be a wash. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. Yeah, I mean, the effect is very minuscule, and unfortunately, there's so many other variables that determine things that I don't think you can isolate purely the gravitational field. You know, I mean, it's a better theory than, you know, astrology is, that constellations have a gravitational effect on our personalities, but not much better than that. So, yeah, I tend to agree that, unfortunately, these experimental results are difficult, if not impossible, to interpret completely. So I think it's still primarily conjecture. There's not much other than incidental kind of matter-of-fact data that it sometimes correlates, but most times I don't think it does. So I don't know what to make of it, personally.
Does with some of the moons, you know, around Jupiter, you know, and all, you know, and then Saturn, you have Enceladus, the moon around Saturn, and that's affected by gravitational pulls, as it rotates. Same with Io. Io going around Jupiter. That internal structure of Io is affected from the constant stressing and relaxing of the gravitational pull within inside that moon, creating all kinds of havoc and all kinds of volcanoes coming off of Io. And so in that respect, it has some kind of, but they're relatively close to one another. Earth is not too much around except for the moon, and that's constant, and so is the sun.
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
I love talking about gravity. And it's most interesting that as much as we talk about it and people like to say that we know what it is and how it works, we can measure it, we can describe it, we can say what it's doing in our world. But the fact is, we don't know a bloody thing about what it is, why it exists, what it's doing. We don't freaking know. We can measure what its effects are, but I have never heard a good explanation of what it is and why it does what it does at all. So there's that. Back to that.
Okay, but there's a lot of work that's been done on gravity. You may not like it. You possibly might not understand it. It has to do with relativity. It has to do with space-time. It has to do with time dilation and conservation of a type of momentum that we hardly ever talk about called foremomentum. So that when you dilate time, you affect the momentum of the system and produce a velocity that we perceive as the force of gravity. But we're not going to have a long conversation about four momentum because most people are going to fall asleep.
Well, we have Wesley for that, so that's not a problem. But it's a topic worthy of discussion, and while it's a Wesleyan topic, no doubt, we drop a ball on the ground and we think we know what's going on. No, we don't. If we're going to be talking tech stuff, it's worth digging into it. And I'm not a master of it, but I'm a master of knowing that I don't know it. And lots of people like to talk about it, as if they know it, and they don't have a clue. It's deeply complex.
Well, most things tend to ultimately be deeply complex, but I gave you the quick and dirty version of what gravity truly is. I assume that most people aren't following me, and that's fine. If you have nothing better to do, type up in your Google search four momentum and time dilation producing gravity. And I'm sure they'll show you a whole bunch of articles on the subject. It exists. It's part of general relativity.
Okay, intuition. So yeah, I assume that if we take statistical correlation, then we have some indication about increase of earthquake probability following intense solar activity, and that usually comes with the delay 27 to 28 days. That would be statistical, but the scientific consensus would be that space weather was not proven that is having direct relationship between the earthquakes and there is and solar plates and magnetic storms do not affect earthquake. At least it wasn't proven that it does. Back to you, Doctor.
Yeah, or correlation is not causation.
I'm sorry, I was doubling with you. Go ahead, I'll repeat again.
Correlation is not causation.
Right, I agree. Correlation is not causation. That's right. Thank you very much that you both are trying to help me to understand that phenomenon. So, you know better. I hope that it is closer to what Paul is doing, and maybe Paul also would be able to give more light into the subject matter. Paul, with you.
PhD with a philosophical question.
I would go with Jim. I don't know, Roy. I like Jim's comment about what gravity is. That'll really wind this all up. Whatever happened to the graviton? Roy, over to you. No more comments for this topic.
Okay, graviton is a theoretical particle that hasn't been proven. And the problem is that there's no such thing yet as quantum gravity. You would need to have a decent theory on quantum gravity in order to kind of tease out what a graviton truly can be. You can predict things, but you can't prove anything. So graviton still goes on the shelf with unproven theoretical particles. And, you know, there are some people that don't believe that gravity is a fundamental force, and so there's no particle for it. It is an aspect of the distortion of space-time in action. You know, if your space-time is flat, you don't have any gravity. So you have to distort space-time to provoke what we call gravity, and so it's not directly a quantum mechanical fundamental force, but something slightly different without an inherent particle. That's the two arguments. Some people believe that there are gravitons, other people don't. There's a lot of argument of whether the whole theory of gravity is systemic. They do experiments almost very frequently, where they put things very close together or very far apart, and they try and see if our understanding of gravity breaks down under extremes. And so far, they haven't been able to create extremes enough to break gravity. So it remains as Einstein gave it to us. But there are still people testing the boundaries.
Okay. A question. Can photon disturb space-time?
Theoretically, you know, if it's powerful enough, it breaks down space-time. The threshold for that has not been experimentally proven, but that's a theory.
PhD, reclaiming my time.
You've been watching the news lately, eh?
You got me laughing. Very good.
It was meant purely in jest, not in legalese.
Yeah, but it was a good joke and very timely. I appreciate it.
Okay, so we're going from the general theory of relativity, and gravity is not caused solely by mass, but by stress, energy, momentum, right? When I was talking about can photon disturb space-time.
Yeah, but it has to be a powerful photon. It can't be, you know, some limp-wristed RF photon.
Okay, then we have a curvature and bending. So we know that photons, that's why the light doesn't go out. As light is also going into the black hole. Let's see.
Yeah, photons have no rest mass, but they have inertial mass. So, yes, and that's why light, there's a lensing effect near black holes, where photons are deflected according to the gravitational well of the black hole. That's the whole concept of lensing.
Yeah, but then if we look at it, gravitational field of an individual photon, that is not statistic curve, but gravitational wave generated by event. Now, I think I'm talking something nonsense. Okay, so let me repeat. So, gravitational field of an individual photon is a static curve, but it's not a static curve, but a gravitational wave generated by some event or its emission and absorption. So that would say that gravity is a wave, at least that. Am I talking nonsense, Dr. Boyd?
Well, unfortunately, yes. Gravitational waves are a different thing entirely. Gravitational waves are waves of distortion in space-time. They're produced by gravitational fields, but gravitational waves are not the same thing as gravitons and quantum gravity and any of that. It's a completely different thing, and that's why an interferometer is able to detect gravitational waves, because it causes the distance between the device to slightly fluctuate back and forth. So gravitational waves are not gravity waves. They're different, unfortunately. The nomenclature is terrible, and it's easy to confuse them, but they're different.
Okay. And talking about the photons. Photons travel at the speed of light. So they do not experience time or distance from their perspective. So from the perspective of photon emission and absorption are instantaneous regardless of how many light years it travels, right?
Yes, right, as long as you're using the frame of reference of the photon. Unfortunately, photons don't really have any consciousness, so it's kind of a mind experiment at best. But yeah, if you take it from frame of reference of the photon itself, they exist and cease to exist in an instant.
Okay, thank you very much. I think people are already bored or tired from space objects being discussed. Unless somebody has something to say, or maybe Paul has something in addition to that to say. And to XG, and thank you very much.
KD2VHD, I am not fatigued by gravity, in the least.
Well, you know, Earth's gravity isn't that bad, but, you know, if you're on a much denser planet, you might get fatigued by it. Your response broke up.
I responded, indeed. You are correct.
Okie doke. You know,
pretty dense to me lately.
Well, yeah. I'll give you that.
I'm finding myself with a grin this evening, and I'm enjoying this.
I'm glad you're feeling that way about it. That's what we aim to please here, inform, educate, and entertain. I say it every week. Well, does anyone else have any comment about anything that we've been discussing, or otherwise we'll try to move on to a different subject? Okay, I guess that answered that. I'm still AC2GS. This is still the Limark Technical Net, and we're still open for business if people have something to bring us. If you have any questions or comments or topics for discussion, amateur radio related, physics, chemistry, biology, what have you, go mad. And if anyone has any of those things, hit that push to talk and ID yourself. We'll give it another try. You know, as I always say, this is not a monologue. This is a dialogue. This is an interaction. We don't do presentations. At least we try not to. I just kind of go along with whatever you throw at me, and we'll see where it goes. But it's up to you guys. If you're not really, if you kind of run down and you have nothing more to give us here tonight, then we'll move on to the SpaceNet report. But we, like I said, we still do have a little bit over a half hour free time to take to your advantage. I find these conversations interesting. I hope many of you do as well. So if you're so inclined and you have anything to kind of throw, feel free to hit that push to talk and bring up the subject.
KD2VHD with a totally non-controversial, interesting, old-school question.
Okay.
So, I haven't done anything on 10 meters at all. I'm curious, 10 meters and then the close by band to that. Horizontal polarization versus vertical polarization. Does that make much of a difference for relatively near communications, you know, 10, 20, 30 miles? It may, you know what, less than that, 10 miles over a geographic feature, over a hill, that kind of thing. Does one do better than the other, or is it a predictable thing, or is it not a factor? Any feedback on that?
It's a factor. It's not a predictable factor, but it's a factor. All things being equal, especially where you're not doing skyway propagation, you're not doing excessive reflection reception, where it maintains its polarization angle. The closer your transmitter and your receiving antenna is to the same orientation, the stronger the signal you're going to give back and forth. The worst case scenario is, across town, one's a horizontal and the other is vertical, and so there's a 90-degree orthogonal difference between polarization angle. If you look up the textbooks, it'll tell you that the total, that the number of decibels of attenuation of your signal is infinite. In the real world, it's not infinite, but you attenuate signals severely when you are at 90 degrees to the other radio station. When you're traveling through sky waves, there's something called Faraday rotation, which can rotate the polarization axis. So that the chances are that it will neither be 0 degrees or 90 degrees, but someplace between the two. And so you'll have some amount of attenuation. The average would be about 3 dBs, but that's with sky wave, not with ground wave where Faraday rotation is less significant.
So what does that mean for us in the real world, trying to spread our signal to our friends?
It means you try your best, and if you're able to, as I once was, you have two antennas, one that's vertically polarized and one that's horizontally polarized. And if you get a radio that has a lot of little features, like diversity reception, you send the one antenna into your right ear and the other antenna into your left ear. And I've mentioned this before, and I'll no doubt mention it again. I had a gentleman when I was set up that way. I had a gentleman from Florida who, for most people, they thought he was suffering from fading because he would fade in and he'd fade out and he'd fade in and fade out. But because I had diversity reception set up at the time, I could hear his voice moving from my right ear to my left, to my right, to my left. And what was happening was that his signal was experiencing a kind of never-ending, varying Faraday rotation, and his angle was changing. So the best case scenario is have two antennas and try each of them. And the one that works best for you, use if you can get away with it, or consider getting yourself some receiver that's capable of diversity reception. So if you can't hear them in your left ear, at least you can hear them in your right.
Interesting. Sounds like that new ICOM 7300 with the two antenna inputs just grew a notch today.
Yeah, it's a very nice feature. Some diversity reception capable receivers also have the ability to adjust phases, and so sometimes you can kind of adjust the phase and then merge the two signals and have the best of both worlds.
Globular, there's weird words to describe it. It's a different perception on modulation. I don't think I'm describing that accurately. Sorry if I'm sloppy about it. But there seems to be people proposing that instead of back and forth and up and down, we can swirl it around a bit. What's that about?
Not exactly sure, but you could be talking about circular polarized antennas. Satellites, these satellite dish antennas are circularly polarized, and they have some of them have two transducers. One is clockwise, and one is counterclockwise. We have another person on the net. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks, Roy. I was listening while I was doing a couple other things here on the workbench / laboratory. somebody mentioned the 7300, the new version, is that actually I know they have two inputs that might be switchable only from A or B or one or two. Is that radio have a dual receiver? And if it doesn't have a dual receiver, you can't do diversity reception. Unless they did something really special with SDR, we you don't actually have two separate receivers like I do on my FT-1000D.
Yeah, I haven't kept up on the specs of that unit. I don't think it does. I think it's just a straight dual tuner. So unfortunately, unless you might be able to jury rig something. Since it is two receivers, I guess theoretically you could pull it into a local computer. It has a sound card, and manipulate the audio from both of those receivers. But I don't think it's internal to the design of the 7300, at least in its present form.
Roger, I just wanted to clear that up in case anybody's not quite following what we're saying. Is there are radios, transceivers that have dual antenna or more inputs, but they're not actually dual receivers. Actually, dual receivers. You could switch between one or the other, like some radios have two inputs, but you can't actually use them both at the same time, or you don't actually have dual receive. What dual receivers like some brands, some models of radios, such as the one I've done with the FT-1000D with the dual reception or diversity reception. I just wanted to clear it up so nobody gets confused or overexcited by the new 7300. I'll have to look at those the attributes of that radio soon, just out of curiosity. Anyway, back to you, Roy, N2HUH.
Okay, very good, Andy. Say again?
Comment.
KC2VHD.
Okay, we have two people. John first, and then Jim.
Two thoughts, and I'll gladly split them up if you want to put the other caller in the middle. First one is, you know, the primary way we usually see diversity used, although the way hams are using it in the case that you described is great. A lot of times the reason for diversity is not so much the polarization, but the multipass. So even in the case where some people might be hearing them fade in and out and you heard left to right, it could also be a multipath issue. I don't know how common that is in HF, of course. That's probably a different discussion about multiple paths of propagation. But yeah, when you see, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 antennas on a home router, they're doing that mostly for multipath, for the cancellation that's happening when two waves arrive in opposite polarity, I guess.
Yeah, those multi-antenna arrays are able to actually aim for directions based upon the signal characteristics. So, yeah, there's a lot of other things you can do on diversity reception. It's just that this is kind of the most obvious example I have to give people. And usually I think multipath is less severe on the HF bands than the higher frequency, which you see on UHF and VHF. You see on television, you know, we all saw, you know, not the ones of us that aren't quite, you know, teenagers anymore, have seen multipath most of our lives. The double images and triple images of black and white TV shows were a consequence of multipath receptions.
Absolutely. Could also be a reflection in a cable. Do you want me to save my second part, or do you want to pick up that one now, or pick up the other station first?
Yeah, if you will, I'll pick up Jim, and then we'll come back, okay?
Roger, KC2SHO.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
Hello, Sam. Are you checking in? Do you have a question, or what can I do you for today?
Thank you. I have a question, but I'll wait for my turn. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Back to you, Jim.
So if I understand it, and I may be amateur in the instruction, the 7300 Mark II, I think it's has a neat capability of the two antenna inputs. And the thing is that struck me about that system, that radio, was that you could have a, for example, a beverage on the ground receive antenna and a different transmit antenna. And that's often required a couple of chunks of hardware to make that happen. Switching networks and whatnot. And for that to be ingrained in the radio from the factory is a really neat, amazingly progressive feature that could do some good stuff. That's my impression. I may be misinterpreting it. I'm curious if anybody has a thought on that.
I think it's a good addition. I mean, a TR switch isn't terribly expensive or take up a lot of space, but, you know, if it's built into the system, great.
I believe that the radio, I could be wrong because I'm not really concentrating on it, but I believe the ICOM 7300 Mark II is, they might use the word diversity, but that's not for reception. That's for a separate transmit antenna and a separate receive antenna. Again, like if you were using a beam for transmit or vertical for transmit, and then you're using a ROM a beverage antenna for reception. I think somebody just mentioned the beverage antenna or otherwise, but I don't believe that radio is capable of diversity reception, even though they use the word diversity, maybe in the, as far as the transmit and receive separates.
Okay, it's a shame, and who knows, it might be changeable with new firmware at some point down the line. You know, it depends upon how everything is wired together. It is a software-defined radio, so anything is theoretically possible. We'll see.
I think it's a very interesting topic. I hope I hear more about it.
Well, if you keep on listening, eventually all topics come around and get back to us. So I can't tell you today or tonight, but I'm sure down the road we'll be talking about it again. I tell my story about that guy in Florida's station at least twice a year, sometimes four times a year. Okay, I guess over to you, John.
Yeah, real good, Roy. What I thought I heard as part of the original question, it may not have been his intention, but what I heard was a question kind of like the following. I'll reword it to what my brain heard. Let's say you and I are 30 miles apart. If it was line of sight, either polarization would be just fine. We wouldn't notice any difference. Now, let's put like a hill or a something like that in between. Which polarization is going to handle that better? Another way to word the question is, why did the DX VHF, UHF people prefer horizontal polarization where local simplex, local repeaters are all on vertical? Is it just happenstance? Is there a real reason for that? You know, what about the ground-based obstructions? We've been talking about a lot of, you know, skywave stuff. What about the ground wave stuff? Which polarization is going to handle what type of obstructions better?
Okay, yeah, that's a different question. When you say that the ground level and any orientation will do, as long as both people have the same orientation as the other. If you're 90 degrees out of whack, if you're horizontal and your friend is vertical and it's an orthogonal thing, then you have a significant amount of attenuation. So I agree that if they're both oriented either horizontally or vertical, it's great. I don't exactly know. It would probably depend upon the design of a given antenna. It's purely its orientation, you know, would kind of alter the effects. You'd have to kind of inspect the change in the takeoff angle of the different orientations that would give you more of the power going up into the sky and not really helping you for your ground wave propagation. So unfortunately, I don't think you could just kind of say definitively it was, vertical is good for better for sky wave than for ground wave. It has to do also with the electrical characteristics of the design of that particular radiating antenna, I would think.
All right, well, let's just, you know, again, which one's going to deal with the obstruction better? Let's say you and I both had three element Yagis, and they were both pointing at each other, but there was a hill in the way. Which way should we rotate for optimal ability to get over that hill? Is the vertical going to do it better? Is the horizontal going to do it better? I seem to think the vertical... I don't have anything definitive about that.
Yeah, I don't think you can kind of prove it on a theoretical basis. But, yeah, I would sort of think the same way, that vertical would give you a better takeoff angle and get it over the hill.
Yeah, so that's my assumption, but, again... haven't and read about that particular propagation. Anyway, fun subjects tonight, like everyone else is saying. I'm really enjoying it. Back to you, Roy. KC2SHO.
Very good, and I appreciate your participation, John. Sam, what do you got for us tonight?
Thank you, Roy. Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. First of all, just starting to spell if anyone's interested. But more importantly, I was calling you with a CW-type question. Are you ready for that?
I'll try my best.
Can you explain zero beating to me?
It's when you've adjusted your VFO to heterodyne with the carrier. So the difference between your VFO and the carrier is zero. And so when it beats together, it nulls out the carrier signal.
When you get to that particular spot, you're actually receiving nothing, correct?
Yes, because it's you're getting the difference between the transmission carrier and what your radio is set for. And if it's the same exact frequency, then it's the difference is zero. So you hear nothing.
So then when you do zero beating, then you go slightly off to do the contact, is that correct?
Yes, and by adjusting the VFO, you select what kind of a tone you like to listen to your Morse code in. Do you like it, 70 hertz, 150 hertz? That's the difference between your VFO setting and the carrier's frequency.
Thank you. My 101 has zero beating, and when I used it, I end up hearing nothing. So I guess once I have zero, then I can sort of slide off to the side to actually receive the Morse code. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's exactly how it's supposed to work. All that when you transmit your signal, you're simply transmitting a unmodulated carrier. Because the rate of the on and off pulses you're sending produce sideband, that's what produces a bandwidth for your signal. You know, if you just had a solid carrier wave, it would basically amount to zero bandwidth. It's the information encoded in the carrier wave that determines the sidebands and the ultimate bandwidth of your transmission.
Thank you. It makes sense, and now I have a better understanding of what I'm doing here. Anyway, by the way, I did order a Bengali key, and it's coming in 8 days. And my code speed's up to 15 now. So the CW Academy is working. Anyway, back to you, Roy. Thank you very much.
Great. I hope you have a lot of fun playing with the Bengali. Well, what model did you choose?
called the Pearl, and I'm getting my call sign engraved in it. It's coming from Italy, and I dealt with the daughter of Peter, who is running the company now.